afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. With that gavel, I have just convened the Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development for March the 21st, 2017. We are gathered today for the purpose of a public hearing on Senate Bill 5540, the Oregon Department of Transportation. And I will ask our professional staff to introduce the subject.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the Subcommittee. Gregory Jolivet with the Legislative Fiscal Office. Your public hearings on ODOT will run from today through Monday, March 27th, and then on Tuesday, March 28th, you'll have public testimony. The materials that you have on OLIS today are under today's date, under SB 540. In order, they are the LFO presentation, which is our 2017-19 budget review. You have the governor's budget there for ODOT, the ODOT presentation, and the DAS presentation. In the LFO budget review, we display the agency budget totals. We provide a summary of the current service level budget, and as well as the policy packages. And we highlight the co-chair's existing resources framework, which sets a general fund reduction target for the agency. Madam Chair, that concludes my introduction.
Thank you very much. Mr. Garrett and Team ODOT, whatever batting order you want.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Matthew Garrett. I have the privilege of being the director of the Oregon Department of Transportation. My job today is to do a tee-up for all intents and purposes. I will give an overview of the agency, but it truly is a tee-up for my division administrators who will come after me, and they'll do a little bit deeper dive within each and every one of their portfolios. So I want to share with you that the Oregon Department of Transportation is an agency made up of about 4,500 people, dedicated and passionate men and women who deliver transportation programs, services, and projects for our fellow Oregonians here. Those good folks understand that a more robust and healthy transportation system better supports the economic health of the state of Oregon here. We are an agency that facilitates the alignment of transportation, land use, environmental, economic and safety policies, and probably more, to be very honest with you. We are an agency that ensures that these policies converge rather than collide. So let's start with our mission. The mission of the Oregon Department of Transportation is to provide a safe and efficient transportation system that supports economic opportunity and livable communities for Oregonians. Now, that's a multifaceted mission statement, and I think the bottom line is we serve many masters. We achieve this mission through seven divisions. ODOT delivers programs, projects related to our transportation system through the Highway Division. That is the division run by Paul Mather. He's the administrator. It's the largest of the ODOT divisions at about $2.3 billion and about 2,500 plus individuals. Transportation development. The planning arm, the research arm, the data collection arm, run by Jerry Bohart. Hal Gard runs the rail and transit, or the public transportation portfolio. Troy Costales runs the safety. You'll hear Troy today after my presentation here. DMV, Driver and Motor Vehicle Services, Tom McClellan is the administrator there. Motor Carrier, our business relationship with the trucking industry. Amy Ramsdale is the division administrator. And then we have a central service arm of the agency, really the administrative cogs, run by Robert Gephardt here. In addition, the mission is achieved through the direction of our Oregon Transportation Commission. The OTC is the board of directors for the agency. The OTC is a five-member volunteer citizen board appointed by the governor with the consent of the Oregon Senate. It oversees ODOT's work. The commissioners during the 2017 legislative session are Tammy Bainey. She's our chair. She's from Central Oregon, the Bend area. David Lohman from the Medford area, Alondo Simpson from Portland, Sean O'Halloran from Portland, and Paula Brown, the newest member of the commission. Paula is from Ashland. The OTC function and the authority is derived from Oregon revised statute, and I think there are two statutes that I believe are foundational that show the empowerment of the commission. The first is ORS 184-617. It says it is the function of the OTC to establish the policies for the operation of ODOT. Pretty straightforward, clear, and concise. The next one is ORS 184-618. As its primary duty, the OTC shall develop and maintain a state transportation policy and a comprehensive long-range plan for a safe multimodal transportation system for the state, which encompasses economic efficiency, orderly economic development, as well as environmental quality. Advising the commission are area commissions on transportation, and in the presentation you'll see a map. We have 12 that cover the full state of Oregon here, the entire state here. The OTC charge to these area commissions are a handful of charges. First, the acts are advisory bodies chartered by the OTC. They provide a forum for the discussion and the coordination of the long-range transportation issues affecting that area's livability and transportation needs. It provides a public process for the area and project prioritization when we get to the STIP, and I'll share with you what the STIP, which is an authoritative document. And for all intents and purposes, it is the laboratory. It allows those good folks that sit around the table to address all aspects of transportation with a primary focus on the statewide system. The membership consists primarily of community decision makers, such as elected officials, business officials, industry folk, public advocacy groups. Private citizens are encouraged to come and share their voice. I think the bottom line is we want to ensure that all voices are heard to stimulate discussion and eventually the recommendations that will make them make their way up to the OTC. The acts, I'm going to go off script here, but I would say the area commissions on transportation, as well as the modal advisory committees that our commission uses, they have energized. They have truly energized the participation in the transportation debate here in the state of Oregon, and I think they have advanced the conversation with regard to the priority and the focus that we bring. As previously mentioned, the OTC is charged via statute to develop that long-range plan. This plan is known as the Oregon Transportation Plan, and here's one volume of that document that speaks to the various policies and goals that we honor at the Department of Transportation. The OTP is a comprehensive 25-year plan that considers all modes of transportation as a single transportation system. Its goals, policies, and strategies address the core challenges and opportunities facing transportation here in the state of Oregon.
Let me interrupt you for just a second, because this has been something that we've talked about at length in the transportation negotiations so far this session. You just said think of it as one system. I know we have a freight plan to talk about moving freight around the state, but I have heard it opined in a number of places. Where's the people plan? You've got transit kind of siloed here. You've got trains siloed. You've got bikes siloed. You've got... I'm just trying to figure out where's the coordination point that says this is how we move people.
I think, Madam Chair, I may take issue with the statement that they are siloed to some extent. I would argue that we have 9 statewide plans, so to speak. And we cross-pollinate as we develop those plans, not only with the professionals from my agency or throughout the transportation industry that populate seats around those tables. We bring, again, a large group of individuals that have perspectives. So there is a cross-pollinization as we speak to the freight plan, how it interacts with the bike-ped plan. We want to make sure that people... as well as freight, trucks, bikes, cars, don't arrive at the same place at the same time. Yeah. So there is that cross-pollinization. We also have a document.
Let me stop you for just a second, because you pushed on me. Now I'm going to push back on you.
Okay.
If, in fact, we've got a freight plan, why are we contemplating bike paths on freight routes?
Well, we have some statute that dictates that when we build new pieces of roadways that might be on freight routes, that we must consider a bypass as well if they are functionally and financially expedient. So, again, it's statute that directs us here. We just don't do it haphazardly.
I'm just curious, though. You pick bikes. It just happens to push my buttons. I think we did what is euphemistically referred to as lane dieting here in Salem, and I don't know how much the other modes were consulted in terms of constricting vehicular traffic to make room for a bike path, and I don't know what the volume of usage of said bike path is, nor do I know where the funding came from. The point that I'm making is that I wonder just how much this integration really works. And I know that you have federal guidance that says on new pieces of property you've got to build bike paths. Mm-hmm. Regardless of how silly that is, considering that we're now looking at three big projects in the Portland metro area, and I'm wondering how well bikes are going to do on 217 or the Rose Quarter. But leave that aside. I'm still struggling with this integration piece.
Well, I think, Madam Chair, the integration piece is actually, it's really brought together in one of the plans we've just developed. It's called the Oregon Plan that takes the nine plans, and let's just use safety as a common thread that weaves its way through each and every one of the nine plans I just mentioned. You can go to this Oregon plan, and it identifies where safety is mentioned in each of the plans. So if someone is reviewing an opportunity, they can go to this document that we reference in testimony here. They can look it up, and they can find where safety is articulated in the freight plan, in the biped plan, in the transportation safety action plan, and we can coordinate those conversations because we have a one-stop shop, for all intents and purposes, that articulates how safety plays itself out in those nine plans. There are other variables or factors that do the same thing. So we have this collection that I think will inform the overall conversation. I guess what I want to assure you that we don't speak in echo chambers when we bring folks around the table to inform, whether it's an advisory committee or a technical committee that informs the overall plan, whether it's freight, whether it's highway, whether it's public transportation. We, again, cross-pollinate with various interests, so we have the robust discussion. There is push-pull in terms of the implication of moving people as well as moving freight. There is conversation that maybe we need something just as straightforward as a people mobility. If you have a freight mobility plan, we're happy to have that conversation, but I would submit to you that we do have plans that speak to that, and they're actually integrated in our efforts to initiate and eventually bring to conclusion those plans.
Okay.
As I was saying, six priorities are embedded in the Oregon Transportation Plan. The first is to maintain the existing transportation system. We want to maximize the value of the asset. That is a consistent theme that my commission and this agency continues to bring forward. Oregonians have invested billions of dollars in the existing system. Let's make sure we take care of that first. We want to optimize the system's capacity through safety investment as well as technology. And you're going to see a lean as my division administrators come forward. You'll see a lean in trying to squeeze out as much capacity, efficiency, and remove friction throughout the system via the use of technology. The integration. We spoke to the integration of transportation, land use, economic development, and the environment. If you travel around the state and you talk to your constituents, I talk to your constituents, that trinity of transportation, the economy, and the environment always come up, and we work very closely with our sister agencies as well with the professionals within the agency to ensure that we're integrating that and not having conversations in echo chambers or silos. We want to integrate transportation systems across jurisdictions. We want to look at ownership. And that gets to some jurisdictional transfer conversation. If a roadway has changed its character or its function, who is the rightful owner of that? And we have those conversations with our local government partners. Madam Chair.
One other one that I've got is I still am quizzical, and maybe you've helped me with this, and I'm just too dumb to get the answer. But I represent Northwest Oregon, as you know, Tillamook, Clatsop, and Columbia. All three of them have transit districts. ODOT's now running another transit operation through the middle of that territory. And I'm just trying to figure out why, who pays for it, where'd that money come from, and to what degree is the bus route that you're running affecting the little transportation districts that are just barely hanging on. And I'm not making a brief. Some of them had hideous management in the past, one of them. How's that work out?
Well, Madam Chair, if I may, are you referencing the point system that is kind of an inner city connection as we try to connect through various regions?
I don't know what you call it. This may be a metastasis from the Gorge Express. I don't know.
I think it came. We can certainly check on that, and I'll follow up on that. But my initial reaction, and that's probably the point service. This is where we connect inner city as we're traveling, whether it's the spine of I-5 trying to get out to Tillamook or so. You have the regional transit firms that you've mentioned, and again, they take care of the good folks within that certain area, that district. The point service is one that connects through and across the state. It's the inner city connectivity for those folks that don't have a vehicle or the availability of the vehicle. That is the commute option or the travel option they have. So it's the throughput, the inner city connections, the longer term and longer mileage type connections.
One last question.
Yep.
Where'd the money for that come from?
Point service comes from the investment in transit and the public transportation portfolio. Mr. Gard will speak about that. Probably comes from federal dollars as well, since the majority of that money comes from the feds as well for transit investment.
Okay. Thank you.
As long as we've broken your train of thought, let me take us a little further, Director. Thank you for being here today. I apologize for being a few minutes late. Our first priority is to maintain our current infrastructure.
Yes.
I couldn't agree with you more. Thank you for saying that. But I'm looking at a report that you folks just put out, the Rough Roads Ahead 2 report, that talks in terms of 20 years from now, if we can't sustain our bridges alone, we're looking at losing 75,000 jobs and $150 billion in gross domestic product. So give us a snapshot. If our goal is to maintain the infrastructure, what's within reach? I mean, what's real right now?
Well, Mr. Co-Chair, the reality is that is exactly the conversation that's taking place Monday and Wednesday night with your colleagues who make up the Joint Committee on Modernization and Preservation. They have broken out into those work groups, and in the work group that was led, that is led by Representative Cliff Vance, they're having just that conversation where they articulate, hey, here is the state of the system right now as we look at our bridges, we look at our roadways, our pavements, we look at culverts, we look at the seismic vulnerability that comes with the aging infrastructure we have specific to the bridges. We look at the previous investments that we have made and when we have made them, and we say if we're going to sustain this system at the level that we have right now, we need to make an investment of X. It's about $300 million a year, to be very honest with you. That will hold us as to where we are right now over the next 20 years here. Those conversations are circulating in that preservation work group. I will tell you, those conversations are playing themselves out in the congestion work group led by Senator Boquist here. Now, that is a focus on congestion relief, really targeting the challenges we're seeing up in the Portland metro area, and that's echoing back what the Joint Committee members heard when they rode circuit around the state, is no matter whether they're in the Portland metropolitan area, whether they were in southern Oregon, central or eastern Oregon, that for us, whether it's personal or freight mobility, we're challenged when we get to the Portland metro area. So you must take care of the congestion that is compromising the movement of goods, services, as well as just people to and fro here. Again, that gets to the relationship between the health of the transportation system and the economic health of the state of Oregon. So those conversations are percolating in terms of if you want to maintain the condition of the system as it stands right now and potentially strategically grow it, these are the levels of investment that are taking place, and those conversations are taking place as we speak, sir.
Well, I appreciate that very much, and I guess what I wanted to do is just indicate for the record and give you the opportunity to correct me if I'm misreading, that if we are not successful in those conversations, with the status quo that we're looking at right now, bridges alone, we're looking at a loss of 75,000 jobs in Oregon and $150 billion in gross product.
You're exactly right. Mr. Co-Chair, you're exactly right. There is a significant economic hit that comes without an investment in the transportation infrastructure to support that economic activity.
All right. Thanks. Well, let's get you back on track.
It's actually a perfect segue, because the fifth priority is to identify and create a sustainable funding stream. Again, how do we make the appropriate investment to ensure that we have freight as well as personal mobility and meeting the needs of both? And then the final and sixth priority is to invest strategically in the capacity. How do you grow the system? And we're having those conversations again, as I just spoke to. These six priorities, or principles, you could call them, underpin the OTP's goals and its implementation framework. And as an agency, as a commission, we always anchor back to these policy priorities and goals to inform our transportation conversations. The second authoritative document that I want to speak to is known as the Statewide Transportation Improvement Program, shortened to STIP. This is the State of Oregon's four-year fiscally constrained capital improvement program for the transportation system. The STIP identifies all transportation projects, roads and transit, that are funded with federal dollars. Most projects funded with state dollars, when I say most, maintenance investment is not embedded into the STIP, as well as it includes local government-funded type projects. The STIP is adopted by the Oregon Transportation Commission and is approved by the Federal Highway Administration and the Federal Transit Administration as required by federal law. I want to pivot. So those are foundational pieces. Those are the principles upon which we build our conversations, our discussions, and then the direction that we bring forth to the Commission, as well as to you and your colleagues. I want to speak now to some achievements that we have seen, and I want to speak in two areas very quickly here. And again, my division administrators will speak much more eloquent and articulate than I can for their portfolios. But I want you to know that we deliver projects, we deliver innovation, and those are the two areas I'm going to drill down into. The Oregon Department of Transportation has delivered on previous investment packages that your previous colleagues have directed to this agency over the years. Whether it's reaching back into the early 2000s, 2001, 2 and 3, those are when the Oregon Transportation Investment Acts, number 1, 2, and 3, that made significant investments in our infrastructure, new capacity lanes, paving, interchanges. We repaired over 270 or replaced 270 bridges statewide, and we delivered that program, about a $3 billion program, on time and under budget. Move to 2009, we come to the Jobs and Transportation Act. This is where the legislature directed the agency to spend about $960 million on 37 specific statewide projects and 14 projects that were identified by local governments. We are on the bell lap of the Jobs and Transportation Act. We have 8 more projects to go. They'll play themselves out over the next 3 or 4 years, and we will have completed and delivered that investment package. Connect Oregon. We are now in the sixth cycle of this lottery-backed bond program that has invested $427 million in 279 non-highway projects statewide. It's also worth noting the fact that the Connect Oregon investments have leveraged nearly $700 million of additional revenue to support multimodal connections and to better integrate our transportation system. Embedded in the governor's recommended budget is a policy option package for $71.1 million in lottery bonds for a Connect Oregon 7 program. So we delivered on the investments, and if past is prologue, and we have successful conversations in 2017, I can assure you that my agency stands ready to deliver that investment package. We also deliver, as I said, innovation. This agency is not, continues to improve its delivery to services, from environmental permitting, programmatic permitting, to mobility standards, ensuring that as we tear up the system, the people move, specifically freight. We have engaged aggressively in innovative construction methodologies, automated engineering, and we continue to seek to innovate and become more efficient in all aspects of our programs here. Specific to the highway portfolio, we are delivering projects more efficiently. Under the clothed in the garment of engineering automation, ODOT is using technology to modernize key components of its delivery system in concert with our private sector partners. I'll give you a couple examples here. Mobile mapping. Mobile mapping is a technology that uses LIDAR technology to gather highly detailed geospatial data of a project area that is much more detailed than the traditional survey methodologies. Because mobile mapping provides detailed models, it alleviates the need for multiple site visits. That means we don't have people in harm's way. There's a quality, there's a safety benefit that seeks, or that is accrued from this this effort. We've engaged Oregon State University to do a little return on investment on this type of activity, and we see an average net benefit of over $1 million a year in terms of using this LIDAR technology, this mobile mapping here. And again, I believe it improves the speed and delivery of projects and the safety of the individuals that are out there. We don't need to have folks out there. Automated machine guidance is another area where ODOT is increasingly using digital 3D engineered models that provide increased detail and accuracy. This fostered greater efficiencies for the contractor, which has led to reduced bid prices, analysis of associated bid proposals, and the cost of implementation have resulted in an average net benefit to the agency exceeding $1.5 million. And we believe this will just continue to grow as we continue to move to use this technology on more projects. Partnerships. Always looking to improve the way we do business with our sister states. We have a great example of a partnership with the ODFNW specific to culverts. In the past, all ODOT culvert projects had to address fish passage requirements. This is a statutory direction in the Oregon plan. And these come with a significant price tag. Under the new agreement with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, ODOT can repair some culverts by meeting a minimum standard in terms of fish passage requirement. In exchange, ODOT invests funds elsewhere, about $1.8 million, to ODF's high-priority habitat restoration projects that provide a greater benefit, a greater net benefit for the fish. In the first year, this agreement has allowed ODOT to replace culverts at a cost of about $750,000 that would have cost, through the traditional mechanism, $36.5 million to replace those culverts with the maximum type of investment here. We are providing better transportation investments and certainly providing better fish habitat with this type of partnership, and we just see this continuing to grow here. In the area of motor carriers, we're working with the trucking industry. This is a tried and true activity that we had known as green lines, the pre-clearance. If you've driven down I-5, you see the gantries there at Woodburn over the interstate. The green light truck pre-clearance system uses a combination of high-speed way in motion, an automated vehicle identification device or a transponder that's in the cab of the truck, and a computer system to weigh the trucks at highway speeds. The computer takes this information, verifies the truck's size and weight, checks the carrier's registration and safety record, and then sends a green light to the vehicle if the truck is good to go, and it moves right on past the weigh station. Green light has pre-cleared its 22 millionth truck since beginning 17 years ago. You can monetize that rather than pulling into the weigh station. They continue down the I-5 corridor to get their product to market. We estimate that the program has saved the trucking industry 1.9 million hours of travel time and $224 million in operating costs as they've cleared weigh stations without having to slow or stop. This program is currently serving 5,400 trucking companies with almost 52,000 trucks equipped with the transponder. So again, something that's good for the agency, something that's good for the industry. It's good economically. It's good environmentally. Kind of that triple bottom line, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Moving to the way we fund transportation. The road user charge program. Facing a future of diminishing fuel tax returns led Oregon decision makers, your colleagues, back to the drawing boards in the early 2000s to create a more reliable and sustainable source of revenue. To develop a better way to fund Oregon's roads and highways, the Oregon legislature convened an independent body of state legislators, of transportation commissioners, local government officials, as well as citizens, and entitled it the Road User Fee Task Force. This task force examined the challenges and benefits of the mileage-based road user charge system. The resulting road users charge, or the RUC program, created legislatively in 2013, authorized ODOT to assess a per-mile charge for a group of volunteer drivers. The volunteer program began operations July 1st of 2015. The road users charge set a rate of a penny and a half per mile. The volunteers get a credit on their bill to offset the fuel tax that they pay, and depending on how many miles and the fuel efficiency of the vehicle, they may receive a credit, they may receive an invoice here. Volunteers have their choice of three secure mileage reporting options offered by ODOT and private sector partners, and the volunteers' personal information is kept secure and private. So as it was in 1919, when the state of Oregon was the first state to adopt the fuels tax, and soon the nation followed. In 2015, again, the state of Oregon pioneered and was the first state in the U.S. to adopt a road usage charge program, and maybe, just maybe, the nation will follow. Now, from those achievements, I'd like to turn our attention to transportation development. And its focus on all users of the transportation system. As mentioned, the Oregon Transportation Plan considers all modes of Oregon's transportation system as a single system. Other modal and topical plans further refine the implementation of the OTP, as we spoke to, the freight plan, the highway plan, the bike ped plan, public transportation. In those plans are, again, embedded goals, policies, and strategies. The Oregon Transportation Development Division, led by Jerry Bohard, you'll hear from her a little later in the week, and their work in the areas of research, of modeling, of data analysis, and planning, informs the kind of transportation future Oregon wants to build and the outcomes Oregon wants to achieve, which includes integrating the transportation system across modes. Modal and topical plans like the freight, bike ped, the rail, the safety, the public transportation plan provide the vision and policy direction for the state of Oregon, as well as the Oregon Department of Transportation. As mentioned before, we have nine primary statewide plans that guide transportation decision making, as well as investment. Transportation planning is a cooperative process designed to foster involvement by all users of the system. We spoke to the engagement of businesses, elected officials, community groups, advocacy groups, traveling public, so on and so forth. This is a proactive public participation process here. So with that as setting the scene and ensuring that we have all voices coming to the table to inform the transportation debate, I want to now turn to some of the opportunities and challenges that we face and will continue to face now and as we look to the future. There are several major trends affecting the transportation systems, providers, and users alike. One being we have a growing population. As you know, the state population has climbed to more than 4 million. It's projected by 2015, Oregon's population will grow another 40% to more than 5.5 million people. Issues associated with increasing population and demands that come with this level of growth will certainly stress an already fragile system. I think this stress will be compounded by a baby boomer generation that will likely need different transportation options as they age as well. So we'll take that on. The Department of Motor Vehicles. I submit to you that DMV is the face of state government for most Oregonians who will sometime in their life either want a driver's license, an ID card, or they may have to register or title a vehicle. And while the major challenge for DMV is its paper-intensive business processes and a legacy computer system, due to legislative leadership and vision in 2015, we have an opportunity that will play itself out as we have engaged an effort to procure a modern computer system and adopt new business practices at DMV. It is known as the Service Transformation Program, the STP, a $90 million multi-biennium initiative that will enable DMV to replace obsolete computer systems, adopt new business practices, and create new online and self-service options for its customers. The current biennium funding enables a series of readiness activities, and we will bring forth a policy option package under the STP for $27 million. We speak about intercity passenger rail. Oregon has sponsored intercity passenger rail service between Eugene and Portland as part of the service along the Pacific Northwest Rail Corridor, which spans from Eugene, Oregon to Vancouver, B.C. We have engaged this since 1994. Intercity passenger rail services provide transportation options, reduce cost for the traveling public. Passenger rail, like other forms of public transportation, is challenged by dedicated and sustainable funding streams for its capital and operating cost, and it frequently lacks state monies to leverage federal dollars. So this is a significant conversation that I know will come before this committee. It's going to be all about how much does it cost, the subsidy conversation. I know I certainly am ready to answer any questions, as is Mr. Gard when he comes forward to give his presentation on rail as well.
Let me just tell you what I'd like when Mr. Gard comes in here. I think that there has been, and you and I have talked about this before,
yep,
a certain degree of opacity about the funding for passenger rail, what the passenger loads are. It has seemed to me that the schedule's all screwed up, that what we're selling people don't want to buy. And when you refer to it as some subsidy, my recollection is it was $10 million last year. Correct me if I'm wrong. I'd like to know what we've spent since 1994, and I'd like to know the source of funds. And I'd like to know, is there an improvement plan that makes this service desirable to folks? Everybody sees it through a kind of sepia-colored tone of, wouldn't it be lovely if we had intercity passenger rail like Europe does? Except I catch it at the 7 o'clock crossing out here in the morning to come to this building, and there are, like, no heads in the windows. So I don't know what the ridership is, and I'd like to calculate the per-seat subsidy. Because while, yeah, we subsidize transit and we subsidize some other forms of transportation, I'd like to know what the aggregate subsidy of the train looks like.
I think, Madam Chair, we're certainly prepared to answer all those questions in terms of the subsidy, and you're exactly right. There was a $10 million requested general fund last last legislative session. We come forth with an $8.7 million request in general fund to subsidize the operations of the train set.
And is the general fund subsidy the only subsidy, or is there other money that is moving behind the curtain at ODOT that subsidizes?
Well, there are federal dollars that we invest, and remember that we have an odd way of funding the train in terms of the car jewelry or the customized license plates, as well as the transportation operating fund. The monies or the gasoline we put in lawnmowers. So we have that. Then we have federal dollars that come in. So we will walk through the various funding streams specific to passenger rail.
One other thing I'd like is, yep, by what authority or what action of the OTC did the lawnmower fund get dedicated to the train? Was that a public vote?
Not sure. We'll have to look that up.
Okay, I would like that. So I'd like revenue and expenses for the train in totality, because it isn't just the 10 in general fund. It's these other little, a million here, a million there, and pretty soon it's real money.
It is.
And I'd also like to know the ridership. I can't believe that you're running a service and you're not counting heads that are on that thing every day.
Well, we certainly are. And again, we will speak to the riderships. We will speak about the schedules. We will speak about the reliability of the schedules. We will have a comprehensive conversation on rail.
I also would like to know how difficult is it for us to disentangle from rail. I understand that we are in the thrall of a maintenance contract that is a multi-year maintenance contract. And so were we to come to our senses and say, stop subsidizing this at the rate we're subsidizing it, what would the exit costs look like?
We have done an analysis. Remember, we're a partner in the corridor with the state of Washington. This is a corridor that starts in Eugene, as I said, ends in Vancouver, B.C. So we manage the corridor with the state of Washington, as well as the intense engagement from Amtrak and then Union Pacific. So we will articulate those relationships, the challenges of splitting the sheets, so to speak? I think that's your question. What if you do that? What are the implications? Could we ever get back in if we do so? The financial implications of
such. Who owns the train set? How was the train set acquired? Why was the decision made to buy that train set? Does it come with maintenance hooks?
Sure.
So that we're stuck with it for some period of time. And make no mistake, colleagues, I know whose district the train runs into with respect to our life here in Ways and Means. But I just think it's important to have a comprehensive knowledge of what this really costs versus its kind of iconic value in wishing that we, you know, ran from Paris to London 50 times a day or whatever that is.
Madam Chair, I appreciate that, and we look forward to a comprehensive conversation on rail.
Cool.
Let me turn to safety very quickly as I start to wrap this thing up.
Mr. Reardon has, Representative Reardon has a question.
Thank you, Chair. I'd like to also request, what have we done to market this service? Because I think part of it is we're going to increase ridership. We've got a product here. It's running. What are we doing to convince the public it's viable? Because I've been writing on Mondays, frankly, and I love it. But I don't think anybody else knows that. So
I think, Madam Chair, Representative Reardon, we actually have a fairly significant history in terms of answering those questions. It was from you and your colleagues, House Bill 3401, that requested just that. Talk about marketing. Talk about the fannies in the seats. Tell me about the schedule here. We'll bring that forth again as part of the comprehensive presentation. Let me quickly move to safety and then try to bring this on home so we can get to Mr. Casales up. While Oregon has made incredible strides in reducing the number of and the severity of motor vehicle crashes, these crashes continue to take and inflict a terrible toll on our fellow Oregonians. After a decade of steady decline, preliminary figures for fatalities on Oregon roads in 2016 show a 10% increase over where we were in 2015. The bottom line is when you look at the numbers, and we lost 495 people last year on the road, and they are people, and I use specific numbers on that because I never want to forget that. But the bottom line is over the past 2 years of increased fatalities that we have seen, it has wiped out over a decade's worth of decline in traffic fatalities. So the question is why? We're trying to answer those questions in terms of belts, booze, and speed, and distracted driving, and Troy will speak to those things. But I want you to know that the state goal of zero fatality on Oregon roads, our fatality rate continues to grow, and we're trying to address that through a safety action plan and the commitment of not only department professionals, not only emergency service professionals, safety professionals, but a host of individuals who are informing that overall conversation. Madam Chair, I think I'm just going to bring it on home. We've spoken about the aging infrastructure and the formidable challenges that we face, whether it's our roads or bridges, seismic vulnerability. Given these realities, finding solutions to transportation challenges and opportunities require the attributes of creative thinking, collaboration, and hard work. As the ODOT division administrators present to you over the next several days, I believe that you will see these attributes, and they'll be reflected in our commitment to provide a safe, reliable transportation system that responds to the needs of all Oregonians. So with that, Madam Chair, I'll stand down. I'm happy to take any questions, or I would now like to ask Mr. Costales up to jump down into the safety division's portfolio.
Great. Thank you. Colleagues, any questions of Mr. Garrett? Mr. Costales.
Good afternoon, Chair Johnson, Chair Gomberg, members of the committee. My name is Troy Costales. I'm the administrator of the Safety Division for the Oregon Department of Transportation. The materials I'm referencing in the PDF file that's related to Senate Bill 5540, the Safety Division starts on the page 17 of the file, and there's approximately 12 pages related to the Safety Division. I appreciate Director Garrett's conversations and the importance placed on safety. That is our number one priority within the agency. And within the Safety Division, the look for us is external for highway safety, but also since 2014, the Safety Division has responsibility for the internal employee safety program as well for all 4,500 of our employees, our guests, and our customers. Our vision is zero loss of life, zero injuries, zero incidents.
Troy, let me stop and ask you a question. Why would you set a goal that you know instinctively or with common sense is not achievable?
Madam Chair, you know, the vision of zero, we have achieved zero in many days within the state of Oregon. The objective is that we take that single day, make it a weekend, make that weekend a week. And there are some very large populated cities across the globe that have been able to go a whole year without any fatalities within their jurisdiction. The drive of saying what can we do from an infrastructure point of view, an education point of view, a behavior point of view to make that happen every day on every trip.
Okay. Thank you.
And the Safety Division is very citizen-focused.
Senator Hansel.
Yes.
Mr. Director and staff, I've got it on OLIS here, but the pages aren't numbered, and there's nothing on the big screens. Did you not bring anything for the big screens, or is it?
My presentation, sir?
Any of them.
No. I think this should be on OLIS.
Well, I have it here on this, but I'm having a hard time finding where we are, because my pages aren't, I don't have numbers on my pages. So. There are. It would be helpful in the communication for me if I can see it here on the big screen, if that's okay. Sorry. No, I lost it too. So I'm hunting around. I'm not very good at this.
Like, Madam Chair, I can continue on, or we can wait for
the... I think in the interest of time, let's continue on while we hunt for the technology.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Safety Division is very citizen-focused. We have a governor-appointed statutory body, the Oregon Transportation Safety Committee. It's a five-member body that was put in place in 1967, established by the legislature in response to Congressional Act, the Highway Safety Act of 1966. Those members are that committee is complemented by two executive order committees created by the governor, both established actually by Governor Attia, the Governor Advisory Committee on DUII, and the Governor's Advisory Committee on Motorcycle Safety. Every year, to accompany the STIP, which is on the infrastructure side of the department, every year we go through and create a highway safety plan that outlines all of the 25 topical areas that we work on and all of various funding sources, both state and federal, that are put towards projects. And every year that we walk through and look at 50-plus performance measures on what's going on within the state.
Let's stop there for two reasons. First of all, you said projects. Give us a flavor of what projects are. And then 50 performance measures. Are those self-inflicted? I have been doing ODOT's budget for a long time, and I can't remember that you got 50 KPMs from us.
I'm sure. So related to the projects, these could be local traffic safety committee support. They could be law enforcement projects. They could be training projects for engineers or local volunteer EMT and paramedics. There are projects related to the teen driver education program, as well as the motorcycle safety program. So depending upon the funding source, there are the various different projects. Related to the performance measures, under MAP 21, the Federal Transportation Act, and then now continued into the FAST Act, there are close to 30 performance measures of that set, 30 performance measures that are expected that we report on annually to the U.S. Department of Transportation through the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration to show how we're using the funds and what metrics we are trying to program our grant funds towards on those topical areas.
I don't recall what's the totality of your federal grant funds right now, and based on the preliminary publishment of the president's budget, what happens to those with you?
Madam Chair, the federal funds within the Safety Division is projected for the 17-19 biennium at just a little bit over $23 million, so roughly $11 million a year that we put into this document for projects. The NHTSA funds are non-discretionary. So the initial word that we've heard from the president's budget is outside of what the expected cuts in the programs that are there because it comes through the federal gas tax program.
Okay.
to get involved in some to the next programs on the second page of the presentation. Some of the areas, as mentioned, that we work in is impaired driving. And one of the difficulties that we've been challenged with recently is the legalization of recreational marijuana. And how does that play itself out in the travel stream? In the meantime, part of the increase that Director Garrett spoke to over the last 2 years, there's been a 50% increase in the alcohol-related fatality counts within the state of Oregon. For the past decade, we've been around 80 to 90 alcohol-related fatals in the state every year. In 2015, that jumped to 155. So while we are trying to pay attention to and make sure that the structure around recreational marijuana and the testing and the expectations for that program or in existence, we can't draw our attention away from the alcohol side because that number has gone up. We also have statutory responsibility for motorcycle safety, and that is a requirement for any individual that wants to come in and receive their endorsement on their driver's license. They must go through a state-approved Team Oregon program. The funds for that program come from endorsements, the individual riders. The fee that they pay at DMV directly comes into the motorcycle safety program, and 100% goes right into the program itself. There is no funds that we are taking as overhead. The next program is also in driver education, which is a statutorily driven program and responsibility given to the department and to the division for teen driver education. It is a voluntary program. One out of three teens in the state take teen driver education. But the driving record related to teens that take formal driver education is much better than those that go through the process of being parent taught. And the program for the revenue for that particular program comes from a student driver training fund, which is part of the driver license fee. And 100% of that money goes right into the teen driver education program, helping lower the cost for parents themselves, but also making sure that our instructors around the state, no matter where they are, have the ability to teach risk abatement factors related to teens as they venture into their career of driving. The next page, three topical
paid, base. Are those all paid independent contractors?
Madam Chair, the driver education program has public providers and private providers both in the system. So some areas of the state, it's a private company, and they show us their financial books so that we have the ability to make sure that when we do pay for part of the course, that they are not taking that all towards profit, and they are guided by the cost of the program is what they are reimbursed afterwards for after they've incurred that cost of teaching those students. And it's a blend.
Senator Monroe.
Yeah, Troy, you talked about motorcycles and the fatality rate there. You said we lost 480 last year total?
495.
How many of those were motorcycle?
Madam Chair and Senator Monroe, the motorcycle fatality count was right around 50, and that plus or minus a couple related to the. I've got 1 year old information in front of me related to this document for this last year.
Okay. There's a bill before us on lane splitting. Can you comment on the effect that that would have on motorcycle safety?
Madam Chair and Senator Monroe. State of California is the only current jurisdiction that has lane splitting, and they just recently did a study through Berkeley University did a look. And in California, 17% of their crashes were involved when it was a lane splitting maneuver by motorcyclists. Given that the state of Oregon does not have lane splitting, our projection is that we would potentially see up to a 17% increase in motorcycle-related fatals and injuries by introducing the potential of lane splitting. So the safety picture around motorcyclists would get worse.
Thank you. The other question I have about motorcycles is a few years ago we passed legislation which I introduced to put motorcycle helmets on all motorcycle riders. And we saw a drop in fatalities at that time. Compared to states that do not have a motorcycle helmet law, what is the fatality rate in Oregon where we have a motorcycle helmet law versus states that have repealed their motorcycle helmet laws? There are several, including Washington.
Madam Chair, and Senator Monroe. Based on the number of registered motorcycles within the state of Oregon's fatality rate is one-third to one-half lower than those states that do not have a comprehensive all-age motorcycle helmet law.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Noble.
Thank you. Being a motorcycle rider, I have to ask, do you have any statistics on how many accidents involving a motorcycle stationary at a red light, motorcycles being rear-ended? That would be the balance of some of those other accidents that maybe occur with lane splitting. You may not have those numbers, but I'd like to see them if you...
Madam Chair and Representative Noble, actually this morning, Senate Bill 385 was up in Senate Judiciary, and we shared a data table related to the situations where motorcycles are rear-ended, whether it's fatal injury or property damage. And we looked at that broadly across all of those in rear-end situations anywhere. And then we then did a special call out for multi-lane state highways, because that's what Senate Bill 385 directs at, versus another bill that's out there that's that would allow filtering in all roads. And be happy to share with you that data page that shows the relative percentage of how often is it where motorcyclists is rear-ended versus having an incident where it may be for another cause or another reason.
Thank you.
Great, please continue.
Madam Chair, if you go on to the next page. The structure of the division, it's one of the smallest divisions within the agency, and we are structured based on the program areas that we either have statutory responsibility for, or there are various dedicated fund sources that do come forward. Over the last few years, the biggest change within the safety division was adding the Office of Employee Safety to the division in 2014. And also things that we've done from a financial point of view, and I'll mention those here in just mention them here. We work in cooperation with the Motor Vehicles Division, both for the Driver Education Program and the Motorcycle Safety Program. So if you are a graduate of either of those programs, you can take your certificate and your card to the DMV field office. And by the authority for DMV related to the testing that you would take, that our tests within both those programs meet or exceed the DMV standards, and they are proctored, the knowledge test and as well as the skills test. And by being proctored, we give the opportunity for motor vehicles to look at waiving the knowledge or skills test for those people coming in order to make that transaction to be go faster, but also take respect the fact that they've gone through the training and have passed the courses that have the rigor that we have across the state. Then related to, Madam Chair, related to the performance measures on page 6 and 7 of the TSD portion of the presentation, you'll see those federal core measures that Congress has put in place that all states and territories across the country must respond to and show both in their performance plan every year and in the accompanying annual report at the end of the year to say, how did you do based on what you were projecting and how did you spend the federal money in these particular topic areas. As Director Garrett pointed out, in Oregon, belts, booze, and speed are the three big ones. Those three topic areas typically represent 63% to 65% of the driver errors involved in fatal crashes in the state of Oregon. And this, the Venn diagram gives you an idea of how those three relate to one another. There are two key performance measures, as Chair Johnson mentioned, that the Safety Division carries as well. One of those, the fatality vehicle miles traveled, as mentioned, those last 2 years with the increase in the fatalities outpaced the increase in the vehicle miles traveled. So you'll see that our rate in 2015 went above our mark or our projection of what we were looking for. And then the second key performance measure is the public opinion, where we gauge every year across the state, how do people feel about highway safety? We want to guard against that feeling of things are safer to being too high, because that can breed a sense of complacency. And we also want to guard against that number being too low, as far as people feeling the systems and road systems around them as being too unsafe, because that can create a sense of panic. So 75% is about where we have found is the place where we would like to be. We have had some years that have been higher. And the goal line was something from the legislature a couple of biennia ago, wanted to see that number raised. But when we had the conversation about the fact that we're trying to do is find the middle between complacency and panic, it was reset back again at the 75% goal. And some of the good news from the safety point of view is we get to the last page related to the actual budget numbers for the division. The last two plus years have seen an increase in fatals. I'm happy to report that through this last week across the state of Oregon, we are down 35% in fatal crashes across the state of Oregon. Not at zero, but heading back in the correct way. Every day, millions of people in the state of Oregon get from their location to where they're to their next location without incident. We need to expand that to everybody for every trip, whether you're walking, scooting, skating, riding, rolling, or driving from point A to point B. It's something we all can invest in and something we all can do better at, because it isn't a spot in time where any one of us would like to say to a family member, to a friend, that they've lost somebody to a traffic crash. That's why that vision is zero, because we're not trying to figure out who that count is going to be attributed to. And so, Mr. Chair, that concludes the presentation on the safety division. More than happy to answer any additional questions, knowing I have a couple pieces of homework to get back to the committee.
Well, thank you. Any questions? Yes, Senator.
In parts of eastern Oregon where I live, we on the interstates, we increased the highway speeds a little bit, I think 5 miles. Has there been any? It sounds like if they're down, it hasn't affected too much. Is that correct? Or?
Mr. Chair and Senator Hansel, crash data will typically follow about 90 days behind in order to get the crash report and the individual driver reports in, and then the analysis to see what were some of the causation. We would have to look at those ribbons of road through central and eastern Oregon in order to try and then do as broad of a comparison over the seasons of time, because the road conditions change. But that is in our plans, is to come back and take that analysis on those ribbons of road and see what changes occurred.
Okay. Co-Chair Gomberg.
Yes.
Thank you, sir. Related to safety, is there any work being done at ODOT related to the safety of automated vehicles in the future? Any studies done, research? What is our responsibility going to be is trying to figure out and regulate that as this new technology as it starts coming online?
Chair Gomberg and Representative Meek. Connected and autonomous vehicles is a topic within the agency that we are looking at, and safety is one of those pieces that we need to take into account. The U.S. Department of Transportation has issued some particular framework around how local jurisdictions, states, and territories would look at managing the connected and autonomous vehicles. It brings up a whole host of interesting, very complex issues. The vehicle code, the rules of the road, all are predicated on you being in a spot of control as a driver, as a walker, as a cyclist, and now are you? And who is? Is it you? Is it the software? Is it the manufacturer? Is it the person with the joystick that's running you around town? Those things breed an interesting level of complexity. Plus, it will be a while where there will be human-centered, walking, biking, driving, riding in and around those. So the interaction between the two is important, and is the system of the autonomous vehicle positioned in a way that it understands how to operate in those complex environments. 5 levels of autonomy that are built into the system at the federal level, and part of what you have in front of you as a body of legislature is different bills talking about how to set up the foundational structure going forward related to connected autonomous vehicles. Is there promise for safety? Yes. Is that going to happen the first day it's lit up? No. We're going to be going through learning phase of how these vehicles operate and how and what information they're able to share back and forth. So I hope I got to the question that you were asking, Representative Meek.
If I may, Mr. Chairman and Representative Meek, I think it's next week there'll be a bill in front of Chairman McCune's House Transportation Committee. Well, we'll speak about the issues and the roles that the state of Oregon can play, the roles that the federal government, and again, when we speak about safety, it really is our disposition that should play itself out at the federal level. Again, tighten up some of those guidelines that Troy spoke to coming from USDOT or NHTSA themselves. The question for us is, what role do we play as a state? What role does the Oregon Department of Transportation play in this transformational type of technology, to be very honest? The last thing we want to do is get in the way rate of innovation in the private sector here. And I think we begin those conversations in earnest next week.
Great. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Follow up, Representative Noble.
Thank you, Co-Chair. Troy, having been on the receiving end of e-crash and e-citation, although I've been out of the business for a couple of years, are you still getting agencies to sign up? Are you finding that still moving along? Is the money still flowing through? I guess it's the question with grants. And I've seen the benefit on one side. Is it truly a benefit on the other side?
Chair Goffer and Representative Noble, great to have you as a partner in that, you know, as an early adopter of that particular software that allows law enforcement agencies to be able to scan licenses and information and have an electronic device roadside, which actually gets them off the road quicker from an employee safety point of view, because it's one of the most dangerous things that an officer can do is at roadside. There are more than 40 agencies that have adopted, including the Oregon State Police, in its entirety. And the Oregon State Police really stepped up by being a state leader to do that, that then encouraged some additional agencies to move forward. We are, in fact, in probably wave 5 or wave 6 of helping local communities get started with seed money to get some of the infrastructure, the software, and some of the initial equipment. We do see that the information coming in is better. It helps both the Motor Vehicle Division as well as Transportation Development Division and the crash analysis. It's legible. A lot of the codes relate. You have some quality assurance in that software and what's moved forward. It also helps the judiciary, because that's information that can be automatically sent to the court, and you can upload court availability if you are assigned somebody a court date right there at roadside, you know, and you drop that need for interaction from the individual and the court as well. It is a very positive thing. It's safety for the officers. It is also actually better related for the record keeping, and we're proud to be a partner and encourage continuing throughout the state the agencies that are willing to step up, have somebody that is IT-oriented in their agency. We found that if they try and wing it, it's a little difficult. They need to have somebody that's willing to be an IT guru for them.
Thank you.
Chair Holmberg. Mr. Costales, thanks for your presentation. When I think of highway safety, I think of things like the construction of the roads and guardrails and good bright white stripes and those kinds of things. But, you know, lately I've been getting things on my phone that say, like, paraphrase it weekly, like, don't walk across the crosswalk and text and things like that. And I'm wondering, how does ODOT prioritize its projects on safety? Is it your five-member commission that does that, or ODOT that does that, or how do things get prioritized?
Chair Hopper again. Representative Nierman. A couple different ways. One, the Transportation Commission, as an agency, oversees the entire budget, and there are pieces of safety, as Director Garrett commented, in every single division within the organization. So within our disciplined area, you know, we're attacking safety from all points. So within the safety of my division, you're generally dealing with the behavioral side. We do help on the engineering side, because we will provide training through Oregon State University or University of Portland to city, county, and state engineers on the human factors of engineering. So if you do put that white stripe, or you do a particular sign or particular design, how do all of us react? What can you expect on the human behavior side of it? In relationship to then the media and the messaging, those are things that are typically coming from my office or through some of our partners, because 90%+ of the time that there's an incident, there's a human behavioral error. And that's where the focus for our safety division is trying to help people understand the rules of the road, the expected behavior, what you should expect of me and what I should expect of you, no matter what mode we have chosen for our transportation.
Can I follow up?
So
I'm glad you used some bigger words than I did about engineering and behavioral there.
Yeah.
That was helpful. But I'm wondering how do you interact with the state police or other agencies as far as safety goes? So like I said, when I think of ODOT safety, I think engineering, which was your word, not mine.
Yes.
But that summed it up. And when I think of state police, I think of people and people behavior, those kinds of things. And so do you draw lines with them, or do you cooperate with them, or how do you split the baby in half on that?
Chair Goffer, Representative Nierman, we have a great, strong partnership and a long-term partnership with the Oregon State Police. In fact, there is within the Safety Division budget a line item that touches over to the state police budget in their patrol services. And we work with them cooperatively on what they then will say their fatal five or their high area where they see as a patrol agency that they want to try to affect to drive down fatals and serious injuries and incidents to begin with. So we support them. We can support them with money that goes towards time. Work zones is a good initiative where we have work zones within the state highway system, and we know when these projects are going to go. We will contract with them through a grant in order to have personnel on the ground to protect not just our own personnel and contractors, but also the people going through the work zone. Mm-hmm. We will work with them, if, for instance, if they see that they have an issue on secondary state highways, so the 97, 217s, 101s that are not interstate, that might be related to speed. Or there may be a situation right now with distracted driving, and they have an initiative that they would like to go forward. We have the ability to give them funds for people or as well as for equipment. Impaired driving is a big issue, in particular now with legalization of recreational marijuana. The crime labs need equipment and personnel to be able to test blood related to other substances other than alcohol. So we have a grant with them in order to purchase a new lab device that has the ability to test blood on a panel of different drugs in order to tell what may have been in somebody's system at the time of an incident. So very, very strong working relationship with the Oregon State Police. They are some of our primary go-to partners when it comes to highway safety very broadly as an agency as well as a division.
I think, Mr. Chairman and Representative Nierman, this is an excellent question, and it shows a cross-pollinization. There are two task forces that we have been engaged in for a while that speak to the kind of the both sides of the ledger you just articulated. On the engineering side, Troy spoke to the work zone activities. And again, that was not only OSP sitting around the table, it was the trucking industry. It was the AGC, the construction industry, our folks from various disciplines sitting around the table saying, if we have to have our people out there, how can we assure that we're allowing folks to continue to use the roadways to move in a safe and efficient manner, but also protect the men and women who are out there, whether they're enforcing the law, whether they're building and repairing the infrastructure, or they're moving product to. So a comprehensive engagement of all folks on that engineering side, trying to change the face of the work zone itself, the equipment we use, the materials that we use in terms of what people wear. On the behavior side, a distracted driving task force. Again, OSP as a significant partner, along with AAA Oregon Idaho, as we look at issues with regard to cell phone laws and legislation where there may be more ambiguity than clarity, or are we collecting data? Are the forms that we use informing the overall distracted driving conversation? How are we communicating to the public, whether it's through a variable message sign or a handheld smartphone that says, hey, heads up, be focused, keep your eyes if you're not driving, which I would say keep your hands on the wheels and your eyes on the road. If you're walking, keep your eyes on the road. Pay attention, because distraction can play itself out in many different environments and forms. So excellent question to the extent of how comprehensive the four E's truly are in the safety area, the engineering, education, enforcement, and emergency services, or the safety advocates and professionals that help us there as well.
Any follow-up?
No, I'll conclude. I'll just say the distracted driving and the 90% of the wrecks that are caused by behavioral things will be solved when Representative Meek and I get our automated cars and sleep on our way to work.
That's a great way to get here.
Thank you, Representative. Right up until your hard drive crashes, as mine does on a regular basis. No pun intended. Representative Reardon, did you have a question?
Oh, I have a comment. I'm going to just pass on. That was such a great setup. So. it hurts. Anyway, so in 2015, I brought forth a bill working with City of Portland for unmanned photo radar, and it's to be used within City of Portland on high crash corridors. So just wondering if you were aware of that, if you're going to be monitoring results with possibly rolling that out to other cities that have high crash corridors. So far, the results are looking really good. So.
Chair Gomberg and Representative Reardon, statutorily, it's limited. And that would need to be enabling for other local jurisdictions to be able to take advantage of that technology. We have been monitoring and hearing reports from the City of Portland and some of the initial rollout related to the use of unmanned photo radar. And the results have been very positive in relationship to the speed of vehicles and the particularly on the top end, people that are super speeders in that particular area, bringing that down. The bottom line is to have voluntary compliance, not have to write citations, and have people be able to move through an area that is appropriate for the environment that they are in and the other traffic that is around them. For me, from a safety point of view, I think it's a very positive positive move. There are some bills this session that are related to, you know, extension of that particular program and or using current devices that are there in other ways. The red light running to also be able to address speeding, because in order for the red light running camera to go off, you do measure the speed of the vehicle going through. Those are policy choices that you have before you to extend technology in ways that provide safety that don't necessarily interfere with safety.
Paula?
Yeah, I would encourage just continue looking at that and with possible adoption, because the great thing about it was it does educate drivers in that area. It gives them an opportunity, a signal to slow down. It isn't like just one of those red light cameras that surprises vulnerable people. So I'm really happy with the results and hope we can take it to other cities.
Thank you. Representative Meek, did you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Co-Chair. I was this discussion brought up this morning driving up down here from the Gladstone area. I noticed that one of the cars in the middle lane was veering over, and I was just noticing, and they corrected, and they were going a little bit slower. Looked over, and right in front of their steering wheel, they were just reading their phone or whatever, and it's an epidemic, and I think it's very dangerous. And we would never, you know, we have the TVs for the kids in the back, right? And we would never allow that type of entertainment in the front dash, but it just seems prevalent, and it's an epidemic that we need to resolve somehow. So, but thank you.
Thank you for that comment. Any other questions? Thank you, colleagues, and thank you very much. Director Garrett, we've got about 10 minutes or so left. Where would you like to take
well,
us?
Well, I think we can bring Ms. Ramsdale up. She can start her presentation. We'll get through as much as we can, and then take it up tomorrow if you're comfortable with that, Mr. Chairman.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you. Welcome, Ms. Ramsdale. Let's keep in mind, if you've come to a good breaking point, we can leave 2 minutes early or we can stay 2 minutes long.
Okay. Good afternoon, Chair Gomberg, members of the committee. My name is Amy Ramsdale, and I'm the Motor Carrier Division Administrator. The Motor Carrier Division is responsible for regulating commercial trucks in Oregon. Our 283 employees are dedicated to promoting a safe, an efficient, and a responsible commercial industry. And we also foster a spirit of collaboration with the customers that we serve. Our staff and our Salem Motor Carrier Services are on the front lines registering motor carriers, answering their questions, and providing education about not only Oregon's requirements, but international requirements as well. We collect over $50 million in annual registration fees and over $300 million in weight mile taxes each year. Over 87% of our customers that were surveyed rated their overall experience with the Motor Carrier Division as either good or excellent. Our contact center is a one-stop shop for Oregon-based commercial trucks. They can register with us and operate internationally through our participation in the International Registration Plan and the International Fuels Tax Agreement.
I'm going to interrupt you if I could for a moment. Now, you're talking about those positive responses. And we have talked before about a change that has taken place in the last year or so with weight and mile taxes, and that involves the opportunity to use credit cards and whether or not you pay a convenience fee or whether the department absorbs that cost. I'm wondering, did you get any negative feedback in response to that change?
Chair Gomberg, we received mixed feedback, but at the time that we did our survey, we had not yet implemented the service fee.
Well, I'm just going to presume that it's all positive then, based on your report.
Well, and Chair Gomberg, I will also cover a little bit about that later in
Perfect.
My presentation.
Perfect. All right. Thank you.
Okay. motor carriers can get their credentials with us through our contact center. We do business both over the phone, through fax, mail, email, in person, or online. And it is that growing online business that created the rise in our credit card fees. And so this last year, we implemented the 2.4% credit card service fees for anybody who does business with us via debit or credit card. But we also worked to provide additional payment options. We only allowed a direct pay option through our online services. We have expanded that to our phone and counter transactions. In spite of that, though, we are still seeing individuals use their credit cards online and over the phone, but they're willing to pay the service fees. Staff in our motor carrier audit section verify the payment of those weight mile taxes. We are required to review all of those accounts. In 2016, we reviewed 24,000 accounts, which resulted in 760 weight mile tax audits, which is low in comparison to over 26,000 registered motor carriers, which one would suggest we have a good rate of compliance with our weight mile tax. We identified an additional $6.2 million in unreported taxes and fees. We have a team that works with our staff in central services, where our collection section is located, and our central services division administrator will speak to that during his presentation. But due to our cross-division efforts, we have also collected an additional $1.3 million in weight mile taxes since October 2015, and those were delinquent and past due debts. Our enforcement staff are stationed at 88 fixed weigh stations around the state, which includes 6 ports of entries and a dozen of portable scale sites. Their purpose is to ensure that trucks stay within their size and weight limits to help protect the infrastructure and the safety of our highways. In 2015, our officers manually weighed over 2 million trucks. And as Director Garrett mentioned, our green light pre-clearance system was responsible for 1.7 million truck weighings at highway speed. It has allowed us to keep up with the changing volumes of truck traffic. At our Woodburn Port of Entry, which Director Garrett mentioned, 66% of all of our trucks weighed are done through our green light pre-clearance system. Allowing the trucks to maintain the highway speed is good for the economy and the industry, and it allows us to meet those growing needs while maintaining the same level of staffing. Our federal and safety compliance programs work to educate motor carriers on the state and federal safety requirements. We do this through roadside investigations, and we examine both the vehicle and the driver, and we also do those at a motor carrier's place of business. Again, our goal is to reach voluntary compliance through education. Any time, though, that a motor carrier repeatedly fails to comply with either a safety, size and weight, or a financial responsibility, we can pursue action through the civil complaint process, which can result in fines, suspensions, or ultimately the cancellation of a carrier's account. We used this authority judiciously and only completed 953 complaint actions in 2015. We have a variety of certified inspectors throughout the state. Most of those are law enforcement partners, and they work with us to address vehicle and driver compliance issues. In 2015, over 39,000 truck inspections were completed. Our staff completed 73% of those. The rest were done by OSP and local law enforcement. We're partnering with our local law enforcement moving forward to do probable cause stops for those behaviors that are the leading causes of truck at fault crashes. We're looking at the crash data provided by our Transportation Development Division. We focused our efforts along major truck corridors, which are I-5, I-84, and 97. And we're looking at behaviors such as speed, changing lanes unsafely, and failure to yield. Based on the crash data, those are our leading causes of truck at fault crashes, and our goal is to focus on our key performance measure, which is reducing large truck at fault crashes. Our goal is 0.37. We were down to 0.39 in 2015 from 0.436 in 2014. We are a leader in commercial vehicle safety. As is evidenced in our report, our out-of-service violations are higher than the national average, which is not a reflection on the industry, but a reflection on our staff's ability to use all of the available data to focus our efforts on the vehicles that we need to that have a history of noncompliance. So that's an overview of my division. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer those.
Well, thank you so much. Madam Co-Chair, I think you were just coming back in when Ms. Ramsdale actually on her own initiative started talking about collecting delinquent debt. So I think...
what a great American.
We're going to give them a little bonus credit for that. We also got a brief report about a change we had requested regarding a I use the word convenience fee because that's what's normally applied in the realm of personal property tax, personal income taxes. But so we've made that change over, and as I understand it, that is saving the division in the neighborhood of $2.5 million a year, $5 million biannually.
Chair Gomberg, that is correct.
That's taking credit cards that you were a champion of.
Mm. Well, I wasn't trying to take credit. I say this committee was certainly the champion of trying to change over, so we do charge a transaction charge there.
Chair, that is correct.
Good.
Okay. All right. Any other questions for Ms. Ransdale? Ms. Wittekind, excuse me. Are you in a position to wrap things up for us here today? Or?
No, not today, no.
All right. Well, I was getting bad advice. Excuse me. Well, anything else, colleagues, before we adjourn the hearing to be continued tomorrow? All right, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 5540. And tomorrow we reconvene and we bring ODOT back in.
Correct. Tomorrow we'll be hearing from the Division of Motor Vehicles.
All right.
What's your name?
Mr. Garrett, thank you to you and your team and colleagues. We are adjourned.